Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of American Criminal. In our latest season, the child of Italian immigrants sets out to achieve the American dream. And if he has to spill some blood along the way, so be it. Listen to American Criminal, Al Capone, wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get ad-free access to the entire season first, subscribe at IntoHistory.com.
Welcome to the OC Bitches. We are on season one, episode 26, The Strip. Let's get right into it because this is a very, very exciting episode. The synopsis is when word gets out that Caleb is having a bachelor party in Vegas, Sandy, Jimmy, Seth, and Ryan all invite themselves along with the hopes to win some money to help Teresa out. Ryan and Seth instead end up owing money to a pimp after unknowingly inviting prostitutes over to their penthouse. And back home, Kirsten agrees to Julie's wishes and hosts her a bachelorette party that includes strippers.
Yes. Lots going on in this episode. But joining us for this episode, I would like to tell you that our guest today is an actor, writer, and producer who may have had a very minor role on The OC, but left a real impact in the entertainment world with his roles in MTV's The Sausage Factory, Growing Up Brady, and the movie Grind. A few lesser-known titles, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, Thank You for Smoking, Shazam, Promising Young Woman, Startup, and The Kid Detective. He was the first male ever featured on Elle Girl magazine, won 14 Choice Awards, and was also named TV's Sexiest Geek by the LA Times. An avid surfer.
I was.
A doting father and husband. A serious movie buff. A wealth of knowledge when it comes to cool music. Please welcome the one and only Mr. Adam Brody.
Thank you for that introduction.
You're welcome. Wow. I spent a lot of time on it. I just really had to.
Yeah. Jeez.
I had to dig deep, Brody.
Yeah. I noticed that a fellow co-star of mine from the aforementioned Sausage Factory was in this episode. I was surprised to see her. Her name is Kristen. She played the prostitute.
Jen.
Yes. Oh, my God.
The UNLV. Yeah. So many people came in and out on the show that I forgot. And she was one of them. And it was nice to see her.
I saw that.
That's funny.
Yeah.
I didn't see that. But yeah, well, that's cool. How was it watching the show again, Brody?
Oh, it was fun. It was a real time warp. It was, you know, it's older than I suspected even. You know, I knew it'd feel old, but it's like I settled into it after like 10 minutes. But for the first 10 minutes, I'm just tripping out on like, it's on 16 millimeter film. Like it's kind of grainy. Mm-hmm. And obviously the style and the hair and everything. And even the opening, like the opening credits, those wipes are so funny and dated. But you know, by halfway through, I'm sort of acclimated and enjoying it. And it's a good one. It's like a classic. It's got a lot of classic stuff in there for the show. So I enjoyed it.
Before we get into all that, I just want to say congrats on your family, because I think, I've seen you over the years. We always end up at Peter Gallagher's for Thanksgiving or some kind of party from time to time. But since I've seen you, you have two children and you're married to Leighton Meester, and sounds like you have a completely different life than you did back in the 2000s.
Yeah, as we all do. Yeah. I would imagine we've multiplied over here, and I'm just honestly, it doesn't sound silly, but I count my blessings every day. Not to say that, you know, life's only positive, I guess, but I'm so lucky, and don't I know it.
Don't you know it? It is pretty cool being a parent, though. I think when I saw you, I guess that was a couple years ago now, mm-hmm, we ran into mm-hmm. each other on a plane. And we were both parents, and I feel like that's what we primarily talked about. And we're just like, oh, life is so different now.
It's an endless trip, you know? It's like, it makes you think about life in different ways. It makes you think about your own life in different ways. It makes you think about your childhood in different ways and your parents. And, you know, it's just one of those things it's a real perspective shift. And in a good way. I mean, I don't know. I love my kids.
You guys were so young when the show started. and I was a new mom. So it's an interesting, that's why I'm very highly interested to get your take on reflecting back then and how life and how you look back on your experience on the OC and now being a parent. And because I know Rachel and I are both watching the show with different, with a completely different set of eyes, you know, now that I've actually been through the teen years and, and I can be a lot more critical of Julie. Yeah. Let's dig into like what it felt like. First of all, when you started the OC, you're from San Diego, you were a surfer, you're Jewish, you were, you are a surfer, all those things that were similar to Seth. Did you recognize this guy when you read the script, the pilot?
Not really, you know, I mean, like Orange, even Orange County, like was its own thing to me. I didn't feel like that felt, it's not that it felt alien. I just didn't know. I didn't know what they were talking about. Ironically, I, even though I'm from San Diego and I spent half my life there and I've spent half my life in LA, I've probably like been in Orange County 10, 15 times. I mean, it's so weird, but, also in the pilot, he was like a sailor, which I had no experience with. He was really in the boats. And, I, you know, that wasn't really my hobby. So I don't know anything about that. But I don't know, watching it, I think the thing for me in the pilot, the main thing that changed, and it changed instantaneously, and tell me if you guys feel the same way. I imagine you will, and I think. But the pilot was so much more serious, you know, on the page. It was a dead serious show. There was humor, but in a drama. And I think we all got in it and like, I'll just throw in a little joke here. And then I think it just made Josh like come alive because he's very funny. And then he was writing for everybody's comedic sensibilities and leaning into his own, which are strong. And it like transformed it really fast. I mean, you would never think like, in a show that started so self-serious that I don't know what episode the Valley episode was, but I feel like it was within the first 10 or something.
We just did you it. Know, I forget what number it was, but
it's the LA.
So first season.
Number 22.
Oh, okay. A little later than I thought then, but still first season, you'd already be like kind of referencing meta and parodying yourself. It's such a different, so I don't know, but so all to say that like when I first looked at it, I didn't feel a strong kinship with the character necessarily, but very quickly, as Josh did for all of us and Stephanie and all the writers, just wrote to our strengths and personality, and the characters, you know, became us very quickly.
Yeah. I mean, the opening shot of you is like, you're playing video games on the floor and you're like, hey, like you talk like,
yeah. And I don't, you know, I didn't play any video games then really. And I don't now.
I remember reading the pilot. And of course, my first take on it was exactly what you described. It read like a script that had some traditional dominant beliefs in society. And ultimately, when I saw your performance, it was a completely different take than what I had thought it was going to be. And it was refreshing and it was original. And it kind of set the tone for this Seth Cohen character that was really, whether you, I mean, accept it or not, was a pretty groundbreaking character. And there was so much of the OC that was more, that was very much like a Trojan horse, you know. It came in like a teen soap, but you had the adult storylines, and then you had all these wonderful Easter eggs of Discovery that kind of were implemented in the Sandy and Seth relationship, and even more so Seth, right? This underdog, this kid who had all these interests that were, you know, comics and indie bands. And ultimately, the character became very, very cool for a huge group of young people, boys and girls. Do you reflect on that?
Yeah. I mean, I don't feel, it was definitely, I don't know, a turning point, an inflection point, a kind of new archetype in this genre. Mm-hmm. I think the archetype has existed, but I think in this genre, at this moment, it was a first. But, you know, I don't know. I don't take so much, I just feel like timing, you know, more than I would take credit for it. I feel like it's those things were about to be they were being mainstreamed in that moment anyways. And here was this great vessel for that. And Josh, you know, was so young and we liked a lot of the same music and just put it on the show, you know, and that was the soundtrack among other things, but maybe most, I don't know. I mean, the comedy too, but the soundtrack was also a real genre breaker in terms of just having modern music. And, you know, if you want, I suppose it could be called indie too, but yeah, so I don't know. And then it definitely opened the floodgates and now is its own. You know, now that stuff's commonplace.
But you introduced a lot of that stuff to the show. Like you brought in Death Cab, like everyone's awareness of it and stuff. And
sure, Bright sure, Eyes sure. And that was at the time of the pilot, the first season. That was Death Cab was my favorite band, and you know, he certainly used that. And then he put, you know, I mean, I feel like Seth Cohen is very much a fusion of Josh Schwartz and Adam Brody circa 2003.
Josh has said that he needed Seth's voice for him to navigate this show so that he could constantly have a voice that comments on itself throughout the entire series. Mm-hmm. That's what he needed mm-hmm. to get through the show.
Yeah, yeah. It makes sense. I mean, you know. He's not Ryan.
Even with the network in the beginning, I mean, Seth transcended, you know, this alienation and this awkwardness and ultimately became this very appealing, romantic leading man that the network wasn't even quite sure about in the beginning. And it was like, and I think there was just such this magic in a bottle that happened with the cast, the chemistry, the fact that Josh hadn't done a show before. And it truly... just doing what he liked did something so new and reflected or even made popular culture more popular. And there's been, you know, the one of the reasons for this podcast is to explore the cultural impact that and legacy that the show has had. And it's fascinating. There's so many essays and critical analysis written about the show and what it did for pop culture. And Seth is one of the prime subjects of that analysis.
I think he is. Yeah. You are.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it feels like a long time ago now. And I don't know. I think of it as like Bush. I know Peter's references too, but like 9/11, it's very much Bush years. It's very much war on terror. And comic books coming in, movies, like their ascension, you know. I think when this came out, it was only Spider-Man was mm-hmm. the only, you know, now obviously it's the biggest stuff in pop culture mm-hmm. are comic books or movies. And then that was just taking off too.
Yeah, that was you too, though. You loved comic. You wanted to be Spider-Man.
I did. That was me more than Josh, actually, at the time. You know, I had that very much in my DNA. And even though I can't say I read them now, I still love them. And I, you know, I'll always be a comic book guy, geek, hunk.
You made comic books cool. Let's be honest.
Well, your dad, I remember your dad and I really bonded over that. Your dad's a comic book guy. And we wrote a comic together.
So Melinda, she brought that up to me. I had no recollection. I was like, what are you talking about?
It was, you know, I was not as informed. I mean, I think it was my idea, and yet I still wasn't as informed of the history as I should have been to write it. I was pretty young and pretty naive about it. But it was like a 50s Red Scare Hollywood hero, kind of a sort of Captain America, but in a dystopian kind of, military, and I don't know.
You're like, I don't remember either.
I don't remember.
Well, it was news to me.
But it was like historical fiction.
Yeah, that makes sense. That tracks. That tracks. How old were you? You're 2 years old. You were like 23, 24.
I was 23. I always think of it in terms of that too. I don't know why, but I always think, you know, when I think about it, when I think about the legacy or the time period in my life where I hear the show, and I think 23 when I started, 27 when it ended, and I know where I was and what I was doing at those years. And I think about a lot of things in context of, mm-hmm. you know, in contrast to that time and that age and whatever.
Right.
So that's how old I was. Yeah. But I also think about it because I'm now older than, definitely older than you or Melinda, older than Kelly, probably older than Tate. I mean, I'm 41. I feel like Tate was 40 when we did the pilot.
He turned 40. Remember, he had a birthday party at his house.
Oh, okay. Even better. So, yeah. So, I mean, I think about myself as being older than the parents on the SNL, which is fun.
It's such a trip. I mean, I've had such an emotional reaction watching the show. Just like, I cry every episode. Melinda.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm She's never
I'm
seen
like
it.
Watching. Oh, yeah. I don't remember.
You never saw it at the time?
I don't think. I don't know. I don't remember anything. Basically, like, we'll be
I don't remember, but yeah.
You
yeah,
don't?
But I did see it. I did see it at the time, but I don't.
Well, I feel like we watched it and they would screen it and like we definitely saw it, but I'm watching it and Melinda will be talking and she'll get an episode ahead of us. She's like, Teresa's pregnant. I'm like, what? Teresa was fucking pregnant or like Caleb dies? Like, I have no recollection of any of the
storylines. I didn't know Caleb died. That's, he died?
See? Yeah, Caleb dies. Okay, thank God. I'm not the only one.
I was blown away by how much story, and again, the season was so long. We would be in the third season on this episode, if the episode we watched, if this show is now. But right. I was still like, what? So Melinda, or, you know, Julie and Jimmy are divorced.
25 years ago, Carrie Bradshaw started posing a slew of honest, provocative, relatable questions to the modern woman in her fictional column, Sex and the City. And just like her, the singles and hopeless romantics of New York still want to know, can you change a man? What constitutes cheating? And can you be friends with your ex? I'm Tara Llewellyn. You may know me from Gilmore to Say, a Gilmore Girls podcast. And after 10 years of navigating dating, friendships, career shifts, heartbreak, and of course, love in New York as Carrie did, I couldn't help but wonder, how relevant is Carrie's column 25 years later? Join me as I revisit this beloved series with some of my favorite New Yorkers and closest friends as we commiserate on first dates, one-night stands, love lost, friendship breakups, and everything in between, to bring Carrie's column to life and answer her questions from each episode of Sex and the City through a modern lens in my new weekly podcast, And Just Like Her.
Julie's dating Caleb, is going to be married, and Kristen's sister is dating
Jimmy.
Tate. I was Jimmy. I was like, that's a lot. That's a lot to process.
It is true that now going back, paying attention to every detail that I can possibly pay attention to, it does feel so rushed. So many of the storylines go so quickly. And, you know, I don't know if you can remember now that you guys are saying you don't remember, but clearly, admittedly, some storylines worked better than others. Some seasons worked better than others.
The first half of the seasons worked better. Go ahead.
Right. No, do you remember any seasons getting to be just a little bit like some storylines stand out to you that you didn't like, or it felt very forced, or it was frustrating? I mean, nothing is rainbows and unicorns.
I mean, two things. I remember in the second season, we got trapped in a mall. And while in like the middle of the second season, I think it was, maybe it was earlier than that, because I think Misha was,
Misha was still
and,
alive.
Yeah. And I thought, you know, even though like, it's cute, it's fun. I just remember thinking like, no, this is feeling like so untethered from what it was or any kind of grounding that I'm not sure where we go from here. And, you know, I don't know. I haven't revisited the second, I haven't revisited any of it, but my assumption and my, I think, quite simply, we did go through too much story. And obviously I'm sympathetic because how do you fill 30 hours, you know, 30 episodes in a season? I don't know how you do that. But I remember feeling, and I still think this holds up. Like, I remember Josh saying that, like, he really regretted, the Oliver character, which is the first, and him and I have, we've hung out a lot lately, or a bit anyway, but we haven't gone deep on this. So, but I remember him saying like, he really regretted the Oliver character because the Oliver was a bad guy in the first, you know, 10 episodes. And, I believe he was like, kept Misha and Ben apart.
Yes.
And like, because the audience was so pissed off, you know, and they hated him. And he's like, oh, God. And I don't know if he still feels this way or not. But at the time and for a few years after, it's just like, that was the worst mistake. Like, he felt like bad. And my feeling is, no, not at all. That's amazing. That's like, you want them tearing their hair out. Like, that's maybe a high point of the show, period. And so, like, for our characters, Seth and Summer, the audience really liked them together, but I felt like we, even though it was fun to do because it was, easy to act. It was like, well, we kind of ended up being on a sitcom, I felt like, for the second half, where it's like, we break up in the beginning of every episode, but we're back together by the end. And so the stakes don't feel that high. On a sitcom, it'd be okay. But for an hour drama that needs to be taut and tense, it didn't have that. And I felt like, still feel like, you know, if we would have stayed apart for a year, you know, and the audience dying to have them back together, but you just can't make it, you know, I think could have wrung some more out of that. I think like Misha going away because they ran out of story, I feel like could have put her on ice for a while, you know, could, I mean, like rehab or whatever. Like,
you mean instead of kill her? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. To bring it full circle. I mean, I felt like we did more than anything, just we went through a lot of story and maybe a little fast. And I think kind of burned out a little because of it. On the flip side, that's why like the first scene is magic, or the first season is kind of magic.
Right. It's like the whole, you know, show.
It's all it is. Yeah.
Josh has said that, whoa, we finished that first season after 27 episodes and oh, I have to do this again. And he's also admitted that he did have a lot of influence from people commenting about, oh my gosh, we hate Oliver. But I think since then he's come to respect that, you know, as long as we're not apathetic, as long as you don't have, as long as you have, you've got to have a reaction. However, he has said that there were a few storylines, Johnny for one, and Charlotte later on as the Jerry Ryan character. You know, there were times when the network had a lot of say. And number one, first of all, our show was moved 3 times in a few years. That's a really hard thing to juggle and stay afloat in that respect. But he said at one point there was a note from the network that said, and this is during the Johnny storyline, that said, this is Fox Network, not Fox Searchlight. I was like, oh, what does that mean? Like, we're not, if this isn't an art film that you're doing, this is, you know, more of a traditional. And then at one point, the Jerry Ryan character was brought in because of the Desperate Housewives. They needed a femme fatale. So there were some definite things that he's...
Did Johnny like fall off a cliff or something?
Yeah.
That's the only thing I remember, but I do remember that.
Okay.
Right.
At least we're on the same page. Yeah.
But there was a lot of characters brought in where it felt like we could have had more exploration with like Luke and Anna and Jimmy. So.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, not to blame it on youth, but I have so much, I mean, Josh is so much younger than me now in hindsight. You know what I mean? At the time I'm like 26. Yeah. I guess it's, he's the youngest showrunner.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's cool. Whatever. I'm 23. I don't know. And then he's older than me. But then now I'm just like, oh my God. That's so crazy. It's such an operation. It's such a big organization, and it's so much work and it's so much responsibility. And, it's really cool. I mean, I'm envious. I think, you know, that's something to be so proud of.
Well, being a showrunner, do you agree? I think being a showrunner is one of the most unique roles in Hollywood. You have to be inspired to write for 1, 2, maybe 10 seasons. And we're just trying to keep a podcast straight in our minds, let alone shooting and doing a whole season ahead of time. So it's certainly not any, I mean, but you've also produced, by the way, just to give you some
toot his horn.
Yeah. I love Startup. My husband and I watched Startup.
Oh, nice.
And we just watched The Kid Detective this last week.
You did? Oh, and that's cool. Thanks.
I mean, what a passion project that must have been. We totally laughed out loud. Super dark, super subtle, and just very Adam Brody, I would think. And so
thank you.
It must be so rewarding to produce your own product or be part of producing.
I mean, Startup was rewarding. Startup, I didn't develop. I just came on and they're like, you know, we can't give you any more money. Do you want to be a producer? I'm like, all right.
Okay.
And you know, but through 3 seasons, and we shot it all in Puerto Rico. So it was a very tight knit unit. We're all on an island together. Awesome. And I got to collaborate. Ben Kitai is the writer of that. And he also, the workload, I mean, I won't take too much time, but he was like writing it as he's directing it is, I've never seen someone work that much, actually. Kind of scary. And but anyways, that was such a it turned out to be such a collaboration that was very fulfilling because of that. And reminded me a little bit of the OC from time to time. The character and his, it's darker, but the character and his relationship with a couple of the other characters and how he fit into the friend triangle, you know, similar position to Seth and the OC. I don't know. It reminded me occasionally of the OC. Kid Detective was more fulfilling as a producer because we tried to get money for it for like 5 years and I sort of thought it would never happen. And then all of a sudden I'm on set going like, I can't even believe this is real. I can't believe we're making this. This was just like a thing I had in my pocket for 5 years that I had written off. Maybe more than 5 years. And so to like, that was surreal to, you know, have that be, you know, a reality.
I want to say something before we get into this episode. I just want to say one thing to you, Brody. Watching the show and like going back into that time and everything else, like you really, I don't even know how to put this. Like you taught me how to act well. Like you made it so like comfortable to just like go for it and not be afraid. And everything you did and working with you really made me have the confidence to kind of like do whatever I wanted and go for it. And I just want to say thank you because it just like brings that all up. And I was like, dude, like I was never better than when I was acting with you.
Oh, so, that's what a lovely thing to say.
I just thank you to and say I, that.
Hey, it was my pleasure and it was such a joy. And it was, you know, I mean, look, I take the compliment and at the same time, like in the pilot, you made it your own instantly and everyone fell in love with you. And then, you know, it was, I felt like we were sparring so well together so fast. And, you know, I don't know. Like I've seen this episode. I feel like on one hand, I'm pretty loose, you know, like that's what I'll say is good about it. Like I did walk in there pretty loose. On the other hand, you know, and I think this is probably a sign of growth, but I hate almost every one of my choices in it, you know, in terms of, I feel like I'm mostly, it's just, I mean, forget fashion and stuff. I just, my assumption is like, I didn't even talk like that in real life. I was doing such a Vince Vaughn impersonation. I was talking so fast and high, but really just fast that I, more than anything, I'm like, I see it. I'm like, wow, just, you know, relax.
Yeah. But you're like improv, everything. Like I laugh out loud every episode with like one thing you do, like it never fails because sir, you are funny.
Thanks. I, you know, well, thank you. I appreciate it.
I just want to tell everyone the first present that you ever gave me was a book entitled Why Men Love Bitches. Do you remember that book?
I didn't until you said it, but I do now. And which isn't to say I read it or anything. I'm so glad though, like, I mean, that sounds a little sexist. I don't think it was. It was obviously a play on the character. I was worried for a second. It was going to be, when I had a Why Men, I'm like, oh God, this is going to be terrible. But okay, Why Men Love Bitches.
If you ever choose to do a podcast, you should. I'm sure you've thought about it, but you are so interesting to listen to. I've listened to some of your podcasts with like Dax and Shepard and Anna Faris. And you've talked about how you thought this Vince Vaughn, you were doing this Vince Vaughn thing. But I feel like now, and to echo what Rachel was saying, my opinion is because of what you did, you elevated or you brought a certain energy to the whole cast. And when you taught me about buttoning up a scene with a bit of an improv or taking chances, and that's what happens in long form television, start saying, oh, I'm going to come to work and I'm going to experiment. I'm going to try things I never would try. And it becomes fun and it might not work this day you discover things almost like going to an improv class or an acting class. But I think, and you're supposed to make these choices when you're young. And if Vince Vaughn sticks in your head or that kind of delivery sticks in your head, ultimately you did create something that resonated with the audience, was so endearing that people liked. And because I know I've stolen from, when I don't know what to do, I steal from something that I've heard or seen on a film, even though you might be very self-critical, it just worked in that moment. So then my next question is, when you left the OC, Did you have a hard time? Did Hollywood want to stereotype you? Did you have a hard time having to separate yourself, or did you have to make a conscious decision to say, I'm not Seth anymore?
I don't think so. And I was never, I mean, not really. I felt like I've had and got even pretty quickly enough opportunities to play different mm-hmm. characters. You know, there are a few things that were too Seth-like that I, you know, passed on, but in general, no, I never felt constrained by it at all. And also wasn't worried about it in the sense of I always, even then, like, I'm not the most, I have plenty of insecurities, but I'm also fairly confident at the same time. And I don't know, I felt like I have other, I can do other characters. I'm not intimidated by that. And at the same time, in as much as that character was me, I gotta be me. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I can only do so much. And I think it's a versatile enough, not that character, but I don't know. It was me. And I wonder if I, like a season four, you know, if I'm sure we all changed. I'm curious how we changed. I'm curious how we all changed in our, even our acting and our style, you know. But I think I probably grew. I don't know. But anyways, no. To answer your question, no, I didn't feel too hemmed in by it. Got me a lot of opportunities. More the opposite, in fact. Got me opportunities that I probably, it's like now I'd kill for those opportunities. You know? It's like, ooh, I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready to, like, you know. I wasn't
you were
even
getting
a good
offered
enough
everything under the sun, like in the heyday. Not kind of. You were getting offered like stuff that like a lot of people wanted, you know.
I felt like I was on that list for sure. I was also, you know, we were shooting the show like 9.5 months of the year. So I remember like it was hard to capitalize, really. It was like, right. Ooh, if one thing works out in this 2 month span, but other than that, you can go do something for a day. But so I think I was, and at the same time, you know, had to be so, you know, so I didn't like do that many other things during the run of the show. You know, I did one movie and then some cameos.
You just did In the Land of Women. Was that the only mm-hmm. movie you did mm-hmm. during mm-hmm. the, really?
Mm-hmm. Huh. But I think I could have done Jumper, but the schedule, I wouldn't be, they couldn't get me off for as much as they would need for that.
Shut
and really? I think so. No, I'm serious. And then.
What do you mean?
I know originally, they were just going to do, before Doug was assigned to direct it.
Yeah.
They were like, it was a producer, Mr. Smith, and they were like, we're going to spend $100,000 on this proof of concept.
On Valentine's Day, 1929, a group of gangsters was massacred in a cold Chicago garage. The crime shook the country. And even though investigators had only just started looking for answers, everyone was sure they already knew who was behind the crime. Al Capone. Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of the new true crime history podcast, American Criminal. We take you inside the minds of some of our most notorious felons and outlaws, exploring the dark side to the American dream. In our latest season, a child of Italian immigrants sets out to make good on the promises of that dream. But Al Capone's path to success doesn't take him down the straight and narrow. Instead, he transforms himself from a smarter-than-your-average thug into the most infamous criminal America has ever known. Listen to American Criminal Al Capone wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get early ad-free access to the entire season first, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe at IntoHistory.com.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Short right. film, and you do that, and then be the movie. You know, you could be the movie too. And Doug wasn't attached. And I was like, I don't know. And then I think Doug was attached. But then maybe it was just like, I take it back. It was probably a non-starter. It was like, do you want? He could never. And then
I don't. Well, that's like triggering my memory of like you, but then that was like before anything. And then Tom got it and Tom got replaced. And then obviously we know how the rest, but anyway, the OC, let's get back to.
No, I don't know.
I'm sure you get this all the time because people ask us all the time. And it's probably the question it's like that asked the most is if there were to be an OC reboot, what would it look like? Now I found that I think Magic in the Bottle can't really be repeated. Actually, Rachel and I have done interviews where people have said, please don't do a reboot. We love it the way it is. We don't want to, you know, too many, the expectations will be let down. What are your thoughts on that?
I kind of don't think it can be done because right. I feel like socially, I think we're in a different place. And I think we're in a more conscious place. I feel like the OC, while it claims to be in a similar sense of Gossip Girl, while it would sort of say it's a critique, it's not. It's a celebration. Mm-hmm. It's a celebration of affluence, in my opinion. You know, and obviously, like, in the heart of it, there's people who are lovely, who it's a family, you know, is at the heart of it, too. You know, there's people who love each other and care for each other and sacrifice for each other. So there's it's not a pure celebration of money. It's a celebration of, you know, love and romance and being in high school. It's not just that. But I guess my point is, like, for me, in a post Donald Trump America, mm-hmm. to go, let's go back to Orange County. You know, I feel like you have to have a real reckoning politically and socially. Mm-hmm. And is that what people want to see with this show? I don't know. And is there a way to do both? There is, I suppose, but in my eyes, I probably want to torch it more than like the fans would want, you know? And so, you know, I don't know who would be happy. I was thinking about it, and I was thinking about, you know, the soundtrack of it too. And like, you know, when you think about the show, it's such a soundtrack. It's so Say Anything. It's such a like music driving emotion, you know, show. And I was like, what would this soundtrack be in, you know? Thinking about it in that context of just musically now, not like specifically what bands, but just like, you know, putting aside story and thinking about the feeling of it for a sec. Almost every reboot I've seen of I'm not even someone who doesn't like that. I hear somebody's rebooting something, I'm like, go for it. Mm-hmm. Almost everything I've seen sucks. Mm-hmm. I mean, like Trainspotting 2. What the fuck? Like, and that's just, you know, that's strange.
Like,
but
like, that.
Yeah, but I mean, as something that, I don't know, is sort of as highbrow as it gets. And still, it's like, I saw the sequel. I'm like, this is gross. This is like, this doesn't feel, it's so hard to capture. I mean, I didn't see like they did a Gilmore Girls thing. I wonder, I don't know. Let me ask you guys, is there an example of like, there probably is. I'm sure there's an example of doing it again and it really working, but who has done it? Who has done either in movie? I mean, you know,
only thing,
Coming to America is a bummer.
Grease 2?
That's right. That's, first of all, I'm not familiar, but also that's right after. I mean, like, there's got to be a 10-year span currently. What in the last 5-10 years?
Arrested Development. They did a reboot.
A bunch. I haven't seen the reboots of Arrested Development, but word on the street is they're not good. What do you guys say to the reboot? What, you know, do you think it could be done well?
If you, in particular, and Schwartz and Savage, even Ben, like, I feel like if you guys, your brains together, could come up with something really smart, it's a tough thing, right? Because, you know, you don't want to touch this thing that like had such an influence and has such a fan base and whatever, but there are ways to go. There is a whole other generation supposedly that was produced children. But I think with the smarts that, you know, you all have and the talent with like the cast and everything else, I think there's a world where it could exist and be done well if everyone wanted it and cared enough about it.
I think you're probably right.
The changing social conscience of Orange County has been influenced by the Coens. And at the head of that, the Newport Group is now Seth, or, you know, I don't know, has a completely different has completely different leadership, and it's not behind the orange curtain anymore. It has, you know.
We got married.
That I know.
Okay.
So if everyone has kids, they are actually teenagers now. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, you know, that's interesting.
Right.
Parents and, you know, I know we want to talk about the episode, but like you guys were asking me about, you know, the cultural impact and stuff. What do you guys say to that? I mean, when you think of it and the cultural impact it had and when you watch it, like, what is it?
I was very aware right after the show ended that I had a lot of friends, family saying, you know, did you want the show to end? Why did it end? But I was very aware that if you almost kind of went in forensically, that you could really explore what happened with a show that was so popular and then ended. Mm-hmm. Four seasons at that time was short. Nowadays, that's great. But if you, but at the time, it's between storylines, between the changing of the guard from Gail Berman to Peter Liguori in the network, to changing the show so many different times, to a young cast that were so famous. And that was another question I had for you, like what your concept of or your thoughts on fame, that kind of fame was so different than, say, for the adults. You guys, the four of you, went through something that was so life-changing. And it was just, it was such a different time. But more than that, these characters, Rachel and I just read an article called Seth is My Spirit Animal. And it describes, and this is just one of many.
This is in the Wall Street Journal or? Just kidding.
Yeah, probably. No, but there's quite a few books like Alan Sepinwall, the writer from Rolling Stone. There's professors who have written these dissertations. There's all kinds of things that, about the cultural impact of media text, you know, like what a show like this isn't just meant to entertain or have escapism. It is meant to change culture or influence culture. And this show did a lot of that. And especially for young people, it's like Seth had this constant narrative of self-awareness, of self-absorption, but it came out of his mouth the way a lot of people just keep it in their head. And I just think people really reflected on that. And also the Sandy Cohen of it, because I grew up in Orange County. My mom said, I've never seen anybody like Sandy and Seth. She loved your storylines.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. No, I see like parents and kids that love each other, that aren't antagonistic with each other. And, you know, parents that are written and are played by charming people is, you know, and that you want to spend time with as much as the kids. I mean, that was very unique about the show. And I think familial aspect, and I think the parents being warm and funny and good looking and all the things, you know, that served it well, and I think was unique for this kind of show. Seth is interesting because I feel like, and I haven't done the real forensic analysis because I haven't gone back that much, although I've dabbled. I mean, I saw this, and then when I got together with my wife, we watched like, not right away, but I mean, at some point, it's sort of a fun thing. We watched like the pilot and then like the last episode of just all of it and different planets. They're you might as well be different series. Mm. But the thing I sort of, so that's funny because I do get like what a cultural character he is. And I'm very, on one hand, I'm so proud. I'm so happy to be, I think as we all are, to be associated with something that just like, meant so much to so many people in a time in their life and was a place of comfort. And I feel so good about that character. I feel like, you know, I'm torn in that I wasn't the actor I wanted to be just yet, you know? So it's like, I'm so happy it had the impact. And yet I don't feel like, and for the time, if I put it in context of time and place, I'm proud, but I'm not like, it's not my finest work, you know, in my opinion. And then also more of the character of him, I feel like on one hand, what was new about him and was good and a positive influence is that he wasn't full of machismo or, you know, there's probably some chauvinism in there, but I don't really remember. But like he wasn't full of testosterone and he wasn't a fighter. He wasn't going to fight. He was going to be a lover and he was going to be gentle. And that is a good new archetype to have, be a romantic lead and a hero. Not in other genres. I can think of 80s high school movies with that. Can't Buy Me Love, I guess, or, you know, there's that, you know, Woody Allen in a sense. But in this world, that was fresh. But the thing I struggle with, or I don't struggle with, but one thing, question, it's my everyday wake up, I struggle with this. But I don't know, and I've said it before in like interviews, but like, I don't know, I wonder how selfish he is or not. And on one hand, he's like a 17-year-old kid. All kids can be selfish. But, you know, I think Ryan's probably sacrificed more for people. And I don't know what I did for the summer character that was so noble. I don't remember, but I don't remember any big sacrifices. And I do feel like, you know, I don't know. There's probably room to be a little more heroic still. But I mean, maybe that came later in his life.
That's a perfect segue to get into this episode.
Thank you so much for listening. Follow, rate, and review Welcome to the OC Bitches wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you like to watch us, check it out on YouTube or on HBO Max.
Stay tuned next week for the rest of our conversation with Adam Brody. Bye, bitches.
Hi, everyone. It's Rabia Chaudhry.
And I'm Ellen Marsh.
And we have a new podcast called Rabia and Ellen Solve the Case. As you know, I am a very smart lawyer.
You are. You're so well-respected in the entire world. You know everything.
Thank you so much.
And as you know, I am a famous Broadway star. Gorgeous. I sing like a nightingale.
Well, yes. At least that's what your mom says. Just kidding. This is Ellen Marsh.
And I'm Rabia.
But we are teaming up to bring you a show like you have never heard before.
True crime meets talk show. Nobody's done it. We're going to do it. We're going to do the impossible. And it's the two things that I love. Ellen, I think you like it too.
What? True crime and talking?
Yeah.
I'm there. Every other week, we will have a guest talking about whatever true crime case they are obsessed with. We have a list, everything from the Lacey Peterson murder.
Yeah, some of the most famous cases you've ever heard of, obviously, like JonBenet Ramsey, the West Memphis Three.
Chris Watts, Khalif Browder.
Elisa Lam, Madeleine McCain.
Sandra Bland, the Springfield Three. The list goes on and on. But they are all cases that you know, and we are going to dive in deep with someone else and just talk about them.
No, we're going to solve the case, Ellen.
That's right. We're going to solve the case. So subscribe to Rabia and Ellen Solve the Case wherever you get your podcasts.